This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, the president said, "So sue me," and now House Republicans are going to do it. Will they impeach him too? Also, the infuriating case of a mother arrested for letting her 9-year-old spend the day alone at a playground. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, is Botched the first serious reality show about plastic surgery or just an exercise in TV rubbernecking? Then, why is the dating app Tinder so appealing to women? And then, Richard Linklater's astonishing film, Boyhood, follows its main character and the actor who plays him for 12 years. Is it a gimmick or a masterpiece?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer. It's abstract.
We'll start with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. House Republicans are planning to sue President Obama for violating his constitutional obligations to enforce the law. Does their lawsuit have a chance, and is it a prelude to impeachment? And then an outrageous case in South Carolina where a single mom was arrested after leaving her 9-year-old child to play at a playground while she went to work. I'm joined today by Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon, who's in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
And with me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hi, John.
Hello, David.
In America, when you're angry and you don't have any other ideas, you sue somebody. And that is House Speaker John Boehner's idea, apparently. He's promising a lawsuit against the president. Boehner and his House Republican caucus plan to pass legislation in the House. And Emily, hopefully, or John, one of you is going to explain what this means, that would authorize the House to sue the president, claiming he overstepped his constitutional authority in a particular case where he delayed a provision of Obamacare. Let's set aside the hilarity of the Republicans suing President Obama because he delayed part of Obamacare, a law they have tried to get rid of. The fact that he delayed it seemed to be in favor of what they wanted. But what is going on? Are we on the road to impeachment, John Dickerson?
We're not on the road to impeachment. Some people think that John Boehner did this as an off-ramp to try to tamp down on the calls for impeachment, which some of the
appeasing impeachment.
Yeah. I mean, basically, because he knows it would be impeachment would be there are two things at stake here. One is there is a genuine anger on the right about the president overreaching. And some of it is, and Emily can speak to this when we get to it, but some of it has a basis maybe in fact. Some of it is people are angry that the president goes around saying things like, "I have a pen and a phone," which seems to me the least threatening thing in the world. So all there's lots and lots and lots of theater that's a part of this, but there is this genuine anger that he kind of gets to do whatever he wants. And the big part of that is a part of the healthcare law when he basically delayed the business mandate for the law that was passed. Anyway, we can talk about the merits of that. But that anger is so hot in some places that it gets out of control. And what Boehner, in part, was trying to do here is channel it into something that might be a plausible instrument instead of the insane impeachment idea, which would get perhaps so out of hand that it would end up costing Republicans politically.
So, Emily, or maybe John, because you also understand these things better, I don't understand what the House would do to pass something that would authorize them to sue. The House can't pass a law because the president would have to sign it. The Senate would have to pass it. So what are they doing?
Well, any House member can just go ahead and sue. I mean, he or she will not have standing and the suit is going to get thrown out. But that's like after you sue, then the lawsuit gets thrown out for that and two other reasons. But I think if the House passes a resolution authorizing the lawsuit, that makes it seem like something they're all ganging up and doing together. Maybe they can create some group just for the purposes of bringing the lawsuit that represents all of them.
So can I ask you a question about standing, Emily, which is in the DOMA case, when the president decided not to enforce DOMA, didn't the Supreme Court, in taking that case, recognize that the House had some kind of standing and couldn't they come in through that avenue? Explain that a little.
Well, so different. Yeah. Let's see. This is in the weeds. But here I go. Yeah. So the Obama administration opted not to defend DOMA in court and then got out of the way, and a group called itself the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group or something, BLAG, formed, and they defended Obamacare instead. And it was called that. BLAG.
BGL.
Yeah, Congressional Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I got like four out of five of those words in there. So they had to make an argument that they could defend the law instead of the executive himself. I did not actually think the Supreme Court's decision to allow that standing made a whole lot of sense, but I am theoretically in favor of granting standing in cases like this because I don't like the idea that laws don't get defended in court when they have been democratically passed, even if I disagree with that law. So I was glad that someone got to stand up at the Supreme Court. It was Paul Clement arguing for BLAG and put out all the arguments there, which then, of course, lost. But that is not the same as does Congress have standing to sue the president? BLAG was not suing the president. BLAG was defending on an appeal in a case that had already been brought. And in that case, the Obama administration had actually defended DOMA in the lower court. So it was just, I know that it sounds like technical and irritating, but from a legal standpoint, they are not very related to each other.
So, all right, let's go to the, what are the three reasons why, if the House passes a resolution, the majority of House members say we want to sue the president, why is this lawsuit likely to go nowhere, Emily?
Well, first of all, standing. Usually when members of Congress say they don't like something the executive is doing in court, the Supreme Court says, sorry, you don't have a particularized injury that we can redress. That's the standard for standing. Whether the you have an injury, it was harm to you, and the court can actually do something about it. So we don't have a conception in this country of standing where it's like, I just think Obamacare should have gone into effect earlier. That's not good enough. The second thing is that the Supreme Court doesn't like to get involved in disputes between the executive and the legislative branches. That is something called the political question doctrine, where they basically say, this isn't really a legal dispute. This is between you guys. It's a policy dispute about how a law is being interpreted or how to enforce a law. And generally, we are go away. We don't want to talk to you about this. And then the third, perhaps most substantive
to interrupt you there, Emily.
And, no, it's okay.
And the second sentence of that is, if you do not like what the president is doing, you may impeach him.
Well, or the second sentence is that you can repeal this law. You have other avenues available to you. So you might remember years ago there was a big fight over the line item veto and whether that had taken away too much power from Congress, right? And somebody sued, maybe Senator Byrd, and he lost because of the political question doctrine. I can't remember whether he had standing or not. Anyway, so that's that. And the third issue, which I think is the most kind of meaty, is that yes, it is true that the president has a constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws, but the courts have not been sticklers about, you know, every single deadline of every law being met along the way. There's a lot of case law that says the executive branch has to have some kind of wiggle room and discretion to, you know, deal with reality. And there are all kinds of deadlines that for issuing regulations that federal agencies just blow right by because they just don't have the capacity to get it done. It's just too complicated and it takes them too long. And so this seems to be maybe at the edges or maybe not of that spectrum.
It would be easy enough for the administration, if this ever made it to court, to prove that things were hairy enough that they had to suspend, I mean, the collapse of healthcare.gov, even though, by the way, this happened before that collapsed, but they could say it was all complex enough that suspending the employer mandate, that there was sufficient reason within their discretion to do that. But I wanted to ask you a question, Emily. I mean, the injury here that they say gives them a collective case as a body of Congress is that the president has stepped on their legislative power and that this screws up the political accountability, which I think I know what the answer to this is. But the argument would go that if the president can just muck around with laws, then voters don't really know which body to blame. You know, let's say this were a law that worked out differently and the president just decided to change it and people were angry. They might punish the legislators, but it wasn't the legislators who did this to the law. And so because the president's getting in the way of that political accountability, that's a harm here.
But doesn't this happen with every law all the time, John? I mean, if you think about marijuana laws, the federal government just basically has made a decision that we're there, even though there are federal laws on the books about marijuana, the federal government is basically not enforcing a lot of the marijuana laws. There are entire states where they don't enforce them at all. Doesn't this happen so frequently that it's hard to claim that this is a particular case that deserves scrutiny?
They'd have to say there was a special harm here that was caused, because I think you're right. It does happen. And also, it seems to me another argument would be if they didn't like what he did, they could have passed legislation. I mean, they're not without weaponry
Right, make him veto.
Yeah.
I do find myself a little bit ambivalent about all of this because there is an executive branch creep that is going on in this country, partly because I guess the Supreme Court has allowed the executive to do more.
Congress is
but
a
also
mess.
But then yes, finally Congress is a mess. But so there's something rich in Congress which doesn't do anything standing up there and blaming the president for grabbing too much authority, because of course the Congress itself won't do anything. But as somebody who is alarmed about our tendency towards executive dictatorship, I welcome the chance to have a conversation about this.
Right. And then I think the problem is, what's your theory of executive overcreep? Are you suspicious of every single executive order the president signs, every time the president announces he's not going to do something which is not straight up in line with existing law? Or do you see differences between, for example, you know, letting the NSA spy on everyone, letting the CIA torture people, rendition? Is that a different kind of executive overreach? The, you know, sending troops into Libya versus delaying the implementation of Obamacare. Now, you might think that delaying the implementation of Obamacare is worse for some reason, but I feel like we don't have a particular, I don't have a good, I mean, I know which of those things bother me more, but I'm not very good on the scale of imagining the executive office figuring out what I should actually care about.
I think what you're saying, Emily, which makes sense to me, which is that if you actually drew up what is the gravest overreach of the president, healthcare probably wouldn't be up there. I mean, you could imagine, so for example, deciding not to deport the children of undocumented workers would also be another thing that they could have brought as a bill of particular, or your Libya examples maybe even better. If you were arguing this purely on usurpation of power grounds, now they're not exactly, they're doing failure to enforce the law grounds, which is slightly different. But we also have to talk about the politics of this, of course, is not only is this John Boehner in writing why he's doing this, lumped in all kinds of things into this suit, saying basically talking about taxes and regulation and how the president acting on a whim causes uncertainty that ruins the economy. He basically lumped everything on this suit. But then when you look at the suit, it's pretty narrow. It's just about the enforcement of the employer mandate. The benefit, though, of doing it on healthcare is maybe, A, that's where they have the strongest argument. But B, it also reanimates something that as a political matter builds on top, you know, combines with, I should say, this anger in the conservative ranks about the president's imperialism on an issue that they're already pretty exercised about.
And C, David Rivkin, who is one of the main lawyers behind this suit on Boehner's side, was one of the people who crafted the Obamacare lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court. And so he has a track record of making fairly, I would say, out there legal arguments, but that then attract, lo and behold, 4 Supreme Court votes. And so I think on the right, there's this feeling of, hey, this sounds implausible to you. Well, you know what? You were wrong the last time, right? Or at least like you were barely right. So watch out.
Coming up, is it bad parenting to leave a child alone at a playground? And is it a crime? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Deborah Harrell, a 46-year-old single mom in South Carolina, has been arrested for endangering the life of her 9-year-old daughter. Harrell works at McDonald's, and she had been taking her daughter to work with her. The daughter sat in the restaurant, played on the family laptop on the McDonald's Wi-Fi. The laptop was stolen from their house, and the child asked to go spend the day on a busy playground instead. Her mother gave her a cell phone and dropped her off. And after 3 days of this, another parent spoke to Harrell's daughter, asked her where her mom was. She said her mom was at work. This parent reported it to the cops. The cops arrested Harrell, took her daughter into the foster care system. How much rage can we work up? Do we all agree? Do we all agree? Emily, let's go. Just you start with rage, and then it will infect us here.
This is so upsetting on so many levels. You have all of the obvious race and class problems where it's impossible to imagine this happening to a white, affluent mom. The amazing
I don't horror actually of a I don't agree being, with that. I don't agree
oh,
with that.
I do.
I don't think they would have taken the kid. I don't think they would have taken the kid.
They wouldn't have put that child into foster care.
No, they wouldn't have arrested
her. No way,
but they definitely,
if this is my kid, does this kid go into foster care?
All right, we'll continue.
None.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe down at the police station sitting and waiting for you. Yeah. Maybe. And then the idea of putting a kid into foster care whose mother is obviously concerned about her and trying to take care of her is its own kind of horror show. And then you have this problem of criminal charges and making it even harder for Deborah Harrell to keep her job, get a better job, etc. I have another rant about this, and it has to do with summer and the way in which the summer is this wondrous, precious time for middle-class and upper-middle-class children whose parents can afford to send them to camp, and just a wasteland for a lot of poor kids who don't have easy access to good summer programs and are kind of bored and restless and left to their own devices. And this seems to me like it is exactly falling into that space. During the school year, this girl, I'm sure, goes to school, like my kids. But in the summer, you know, my kids can be off at camp and this girl doesn't have that opportunity. And I just, like, that makes me so upset as the another subtext for the story.
Right. And then if you have a park, which might be one way to provide a place for kids who can't go to school to hang out, like you can't even hang out in the park.
Right. Or at least not unsupervised. Do we think, though, that it's a good idea to leave your 9-year-old unsupervised in the park for the whole day? Because I don't. I will say I don't.
It's not a great idea if you have choices. If you don't have choices, it seems like a pretty – it doesn't seem like the worst place to leave somebody. Better than leaving them indoors without or not around other people.
Have we looked at the statute in South Carolina about whether it would have been endangerment to leave her home alone all day?
Well, the statute in South Carolina, like the statute everywhere, is very vague. It's about, you know, being reasonable, providing reasonable supervision under the circumstances, which is always what these laws say. So, like, if you leave, you know, I have definitely left my 11-year-old home for some amount of time. And the jokes about, well, how long could that last for before you get in trouble? There's no answer to that question because it's all very discretionary from the point of view of the state.
We don't really need to get to this because it's been made. The point has been made. But one reason why everyone's so outraged is, oh, what if the child had been abducted? And of course, we just have to point out, there are so few stranger abductions in this country, as you might as well say none. There are not none, but there are just so few. Someone calculated that if you leave a child alone in a car, the child would have to wait there for 750,000 years before the child would be abducted by a stranger.
So this is where it gets back to
it's so much more. Right. It's so much more dangerous to drive around with your kid in the car just based on the number of car accidents than it is to leave a child alone in the park.
Doesn't this go back to Emily's original point about race and class, which is that it's not the thing itself for which the mother was arrested, but it was tip of the iceberg. So if the kid's being left alone in a park all day, then untold horrible other things are a part of her life, too. That sign of you don't have discrete negligence. That it's.
Can we also say, what person called the police on
this
kid?
Oh, like, no. This is – oh, good. This is where we're going to have a fight. As somebody whose natural instincts would be, like, I don't have the capacity to deal with this. I don't know this mother. I don't know where she works. And
– oh, gee, I think I'll call the police on her and trust them to figure it out. Why would you ever do that?
Because the police –
you live in a city where the police sometimes make mistakes and do bad things.
Of course the police make mistakes and do bad things, but I certainly trust the police more than I trust, like, random human beings to try to sort out what's going on with a kid and make sure a kid has a safe.
This is the girl's mom. Like, this happened without any conversation with this girl's mother to judge what kind of decision making and judgment she had.
What did they call? What did they call the mom? They called the mom, and the mom is like, you know, because she's working the fryer. She's like her, you know, she's serving customers. She cannot answer the phone that second.
I mean, that's an interesting question, but it didn't happen in this case. There's no evidence about the mom.
Know.
She's absent from that decision.
Your kind of reflexive assumption that the cops should not be involved in this seems to me totally off base. The problem is not that the cops are involved. The problem is that the law is vague, and the law is out there to be the prosecutors, and the cops have used it in the wrong way.
Yeah, but the reason I feel so strongly about this is in all the talks I've given in the last few years about bullying and all the communities I've been in, there is such a nostalgia.
Don't tell an authority figure. Emily's view
which...
is like, if you're being bullied, do not tell an authority. Don't tell the police if you're being bullied.
Well,
I think talking
to the police is a big problem and leads to a lot more suspensions and expulsions of kids. And there's a lot of evidence that is, in fact, a big problem with reporting bullying to the police. What I was going to say is that, in part, I think because of that awareness, there's a lot of nostalgia among people for a world in which adults kept an eye out for other people's kids and were able to say, hey – you know, your kid was rude, or, hey, who is watching your kid in the park? And it all just kind of happened within the community. It was not, you know, something that had to be involved the police or the principal or the whoever, that we just had ways of talking about stuff and working it out. And this really deeply feels to me like an example
of
that.
But Emily,
well,
yes,
I don't mean to personalize this
scenario
too much, but the park near my house where my kids occasionally go by themselves is not actually a place where anyone knows. It's big and people come from all over the city. It's super diverse. People are, you know, adults are playing basketball and kids are racing around. But if I saw a kid who was like different from my kid in class and race doing something I thought was wrong, I would try to go talk to that kid or the parent. It would not occur to me in a million years that calling the New Haven police would be a wise move.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Richard Linklater's new movie Boyhood was filmed with the same cast over 12 years. It's a testament to beings in time and is being hailed as a masterpiece. Botched is not so being hailed. It's a reality TV show about plastic surgery gone wrong. And finally, Tinder, the hookup site, has done what no one thought possible. It appeals to women. Joining me today is Slate's newly named editor-in-chief, Julia Turner.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right, digging in. Richard Linklater's new and astonishing film follows a boy as he grows up. It doesn't sound like much, except Boyhood was filmed over 12 years and with the same cast. So, in fact, you follow along as an actual boy passes from childhood into early manhood. The boy in question is Mason, played by L.R. Coltrane, and it follows his life in Texas, where Linklater himself grew up, as Mason's parents separate, as his mother remarries, and I won't spoil the movie any further, but through his first beard, first girlfriend, etc. His sister Samantha is played by Linklater's true life daughter. His mother is played wonderfully, I think, by Patricia Arquette, and equally wonderfully, his father is played by Ethan Hawke. But I must not make this movie sound trite, Dana. This is the last thing that it is. Linklater, who's known for Slacker, Dazed and Confused, and the Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy Sunrise trilogy, he's always been interested in the dense interconnection between an actor and his role or her role, between improvisation and script, and between beings and time and parts and wholes. This movie is being hailed, I think rightly, as his masterpiece. I never read your reviews, Dana. I always want to hear what you think fresh, and I'm always dying to know what you think, but I'm especially so today. What do you think of this movie? Is it a masterpiece?
Masterpiece is it's an awkward word to throw around, and this movie has been so widely praised that it feels sort of embarrassing to be part of the praise. But I've been waiting to write about this movie for 6 months. I saw it back in January at Sundance, and it just has such a special... It's almost not a movie. I think it's going to be hard to talk about for that reason, is that you don't really experience the unfolding of its 2 hours and 40 minutes as a normal narrative movie. And I find that sort of hard to explain. It's somewhere in between sort of a family album, right?
Absolutely.
And some sort of diary of the passage of time. It's sort of contemplative. It kind of unfolds slowly, although I think the time races by when you're in it. And it leaves you feeling that you've joined a world, you know, that you've really been sort of generously invited into this world. And I have a lot more to say about that, but I will leave it at that. I love Boyhood, and I think everyone should see it.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you go into a movie, Julia, and the lights dim, and you're in Plato's cave, and it's just, it is so intrinsically an amazing experience to be inside a movie theater and have the screen light up and things start to happen. And the disappointing fact is always when you become... You can measure a movie by when you become reaware of your body. And a crappy movie, it's within 5 minutes, you're shifting a little bit, whatever. I mean, I don't know about you. I got well in excess of 2 hours into this movie before I was aware that I was an embodied being again. I found it captivating. What did you think?
Well, I certainly think everybody in the world should see it. I love Richard Linklater's movies. I'm a huge fan of his work. And it's a completely unique, unusual project. And to see this boy, who's a wonderful actor, grow up in real time, to see and kind of check in episodically on the evolution of his mother and father getting their lives together in various different ways is totally fascinating and wonderful. I found myself wondering, it did not pass all that quickly for me, and I did find myself wondering sometimes if this wasn't more of a movie that's interesting because of the stunt of its construction rather than its total execution. Like, I found myself wondering, what if there were 10 movies about growing up that had been made in this way would this one be particularly good in terms of the way its story was told, in terms of how different signals and shifts were telegraphed, in terms of the performances? And I found myself speculating that if you were to make 10 movies this way, this one might be in the middle of the pack. Does that sound ungenerous? Of course, nobody's going to make 10 movies that way. And the titanic nature of the achievement of it is remarkable in and of itself. So I feel miserly raising this question. But I felt like some of the performances weren't great. Some of the, you know, because we had to be inserted episodically into, you know, 12 different years of this boy's life, you had to signal shifts in how to feel about different characters very swiftly, and as a result, sometimes kind of broadly and clunkily, like, uh-oh, the stepdad pulled up at the liquor store. And then sure enough, in the next shot, like, the inevitable happens. So not an unmitigated rave over here.
So the heartless backlash has begun.
Well, actually, both the things that Julia just mentioned are kind of caveats that I mentioned in my review, which did not take away from the overall experience of loving the film. I mean, any project like this, which Julia's right, I mean, nobody else would undertake this project, or maybe someone else will try to now. But I think Richard Linklater is a filmmaker who's particularly attuned and has been, Steve, as you said, for his whole career to the kind of questions that this project brings up. But yeah, my caveats did have to do with irregularity in performances. You know, I mean, when you're casting non-professional actors alongside professional actors, which Linklater did, you can't be sure that they'll be acting on the same page at all times. And I think Ella Coltrane, who was cast when he was only 6 or 7 years old, incredibly did sort of grow up to be an actor who was on the level of Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke. Lorelai Linklater, Linklater's daughter, I think is really sweet and charming in the early scenes and is very comfortable on camera. But as she grows up, it does not grow up into an actress. And, you know, the backstory of the film is that she got increasingly tired of the project and asked her father to kill off her character, which he refused to do because he didn't want things to happen like the sister dying in the movie. He wanted to keep the story more quotidian and more sort of about real life and what happens in most people's lives.
Yeah. I don't disagree with what Julia said. It's of course it's built around a central, I guess you could call it stunt or gimmick. You know, it just comes down to whether you think it transcends it or doesn't. It's the movie's kind of in a weird way a hybrid of the 7-Up documentaries made by
Michael Apted.
Yeah, Michael Apted. Thank you. And a Richard Linklater film. You can't experience it or judge it as a normal feature film in some way. He absolutely got the serendipity of this kid growing up into the kid he grows up into without giving anything away in the movie. You know, he grows from a kind of, I wouldn't say generic, but he grows from a 6-year-old, you know, kind of unformed, a little bit doughy, you know, ectoplasmic little fledgling into a really, I think, captivating, borderline mesmerizing young adolescent boy.
And someone who, interestingly, is a kind of alter ego for Richard Linklater. Yeah. I mean, some of the rants that he comes up with at the end, which apparently he sort of developed, you know, along with the director, the stuff about technology. He's sort of this Luddite, you know, he seems like he's a little bit of a community-minded artist in the way that Richard Linklater is. And it seems obvious that the two of them may have influenced each other over the process of growing
up. But I found those exact particular rants at the end of the film to be somewhat unconvincing. Like, I felt like Richard Linklater, the, you know, however old he is, man, was like popping up in the mouth of this 15-year-old boy to complain about Facebook. That was like my least favorite scene, was the boy complaining about
Facebook. But apparently that was essentially written by the two of them together based on Ella Coltrane's actual feelings about Facebook. I mean, I guess as a lover of Richard Linklater movies, I always like those slacker moments. There's always some crazy rant. Richard Linklater himself begins the movie Slacker by getting in the back of a cab. Do you remember this? And doing this sort of like 5-minute free associative rant to the cab driver. And of course, Slacker is all about sort of successive weirdos through Austin ranting. So I guess I like that part. I like the kind of oddball theory spinning that always happens in a Richard Linklater movie. Oh, and the Before movies, of course, are all about two people doing that together.
Anyway, the movie is called Boyhood. It's in narrow release right now. It goes wider very soon, I think next week, and I think it's going to go wider after that. My prediction is this movie does an astonishing amount of business relative to its ambitions. We'll see. Tell us what you think about it. Go see it. It's a remarkable film. We're at facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, does the plastic surgery reality TV show Botched simply serve up voyeurism, or does it actually teach us something? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, guess what? We collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, while you're there, if you would, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. America was drunk on physical comeliness, the great Frederick Exley once wrote. And from the evidence of the new E! Show, Botched, we're drunk on schadenfreude and sheer nonsense as well. Botched is a reality TV plastic surgery show. It centers on two surgeons, Terry Dubrow and Paul Nassif, who practice what one calls, quote, revision plastic surgery, unquote. They go in and fix the mistakes of the dubiously motivated and the ambiguously credentialed surgeons who have botched up someone's body. It would seem to hit the two major notes necessary to the reality genre. It's both a helping of schadenfreude, you see where vanity leads some poor souls, and a Frankenstein into a swan feel-good special, I guess, at moments. At least Dana, I have to say, I don't get this show because my Tijuana tummy tuck worked out perfectly. You know, so the idea that you need to go back and correct it is, but in all seriousness, how nauseated were you by this television show?
Well, Botched, you're right. It has heaping helpings of all kinds of recipes for reality television that you don't necessarily always find together in the same show. So it's some mixture of a show like The Swan, which was a plastic surgery makeover show, and then something almost more like Keeping Up with the Kardashians or something. I'm not well-versed enough to know the closest cognate to this in reality TV world, but something about watching, you know, people with really bad ideas and trashy tastes kind of execute their will. Very wealthy people who can do whatever they want with their bodies kind of making big mistakes. So I guess, yeah, schadenfreude is the emotion that's supposed to be felt. But as I talked about when we did Keeping Up with the Kardashians, I believe in a live show I remember doing the Kardashians, I guess I just don't get the entertainment value of that particular emotion. I'm not trying to rise above it or be on moral high ground or anything. I just really don't see the fun in watching a person's botched plastic surgery be fixed. So this show was a weird watch for me. But it does have this strange mix of stories in each episode. So it's an hour long, way too long, like every reality show with like 500 establishing shots of the medical building where the doctors practice. There's tons of filler in it. But every time there's three stories, basically. And at least in the three of the four existing episodes that I saw, every time one person is rejected who comes to ask for plastic surgery. So that seems to be a narrative the show wants to repeat again and again, that these doctors are not such bottom feeders that they're going to take anybody on. And mm-hmm. So if somebody comes in who has body dysmorphic disorder and admits it straight out, right? Somebody comes in who, like the young gay man who's already sort of made himself into this human Ken doll, and he's not having a botched surgery fixed. He just wants more on top of what he's already done. They turn him down. So every time they seem to turn somebody down, mm-hmm. then they also have one person who's kind of a freak. And then there's the nice person. You know, there's somebody who's having plastic surgery for a non-vanity reason because their nose was broken as a child and was never fixed right. A person who's just sort of a normal person that you can be happy for as they get their face back that mm-hmm. they used to have. And so I think the show is trying to have all three of those feelings at once. I also just discovered in researching it that both of these doctors are either the husband or the ex-husband of a Real Housewife on one of the Real Housewives shows.
Amazing,
which makes you realize that there's this whole interconnected labyrinth of reality shows out there that sort of feed each other's maw, and that kind of grosses me out.
I know. Well, what do you think, Julia? Is there a tincture of humanity or ethical, you know, high standards here? Because it is about correcting what, you know, people of quite low standards have done to someone previously, or is that just having its cake and eating it too?
I feel like this is the reality TV machine getting slightly smarter about itself. You know, if 10 years ago there was just The Swan or Celebrity Makeover where we were, you know, unmitigatedly gawking at people who wanted to, you know, disfigure their bodies with unnecessary surgeries because they were essentially crazy and we were watching like the sad insanity of people on television for, to my mind, no good reason, this is trying to offer up a more complex bouillabaisse where there's this mixture of carefully calibrated emotions that Dana suggests. And instead of just purely gawking at the clients, they've given us these heroes in the form of these eminently reasonable plastic surgeons. Like, they somehow found these heroes in these weird, overly tanned LA surgeon bros who I had not realized that they were housewife husband material or ex-husbands or whatever they are. By making them the heroes and by carefully putting them in a position where they are just so reasonable, it makes the thing feel slightly more palatable to watch, you know. And obviously plastic surgery is a good idea for a before and after type reality show because it's so visual, not to mention slightly gory. I mean, the surgery scenes are gross. But I found that all very icky because what those eminently reasonable plastic surgeons still do is just take as a given that, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, modifying getting breast implants, of course, is totally fine, but you're crazy not to change them every 10 years. Like, leaving them in for 30 years, that was your problem, Janice Dickinson. I mean, whatever. People want to do whatever to their body. I'm not really going to judge it. But the sort of moral, it's a slightly expanded moral universe from the reality show of 10 years ago, but it never gets to maybe just don't have plastic surgery, mm-hmm. which is a moral universe that I live in.
Right. And okay, so I agree with you. I disagree with your whatever, and I agree with your subsequent thought, which is, well, not outrage, but let's get to the outrage, but let's get there philosophically, as it were. Dana, what is it about plastic surgery that might offend a certain person's sensibility? Is it that we think that one should develop character in relation to what, you know, God or nature has given you relative to your body and your facial structure? Do we think that to the degree that you modify it, it too ought to exhibit some kind of character, therefore I should do sit-ups instead of getting a tummy tuck, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Is that a kind of, in the media age, right, is that an anachronistic, Calvinistic, you know, the way one looks ought to have some relationship to one's character or state of grace? Is that just another century speaking through uptight Brooklyn culture critics like you and me? Or is there, you know, ought we judge plastic surgery, setting aside the show?
I mean, I think it exists along a continuum. I'm not sure that I take the whatever my classic Brooklyn cultural critic position is supposed to be, that plastic surgery is wrong and we're departing from there. I mean, one of the spectrums that it exists on is gender. And there's a character in, I think, the second or third show who's a male-to-female transgender person who has already done, I think, major surgery, has definitely already done bottom surgery and all that stuff, but basically wants to step back. You know, it's a porn star too. This woman is a porn star and now wants to kind of step back the size of her breasts to merely D and not double D or something, and get a more natural looking nose. And so there is some movement toward a less changed body.
You know, I feel like in my mind, I've always made the decision between, like, well, I would just like to have a different body than the one that I have. And then as I've grown older, I've thought, oh, well, then there's the version of plastic surgery, which is just like the version of my face that exists in my head is not actually the face that stares me in the mirror. And some people get fixated upon that enough to have Botox or do more things that end up making them look fake and old and weird. But, you know, there's sort of those two motives. But, you know, the world of trans politics and trans rights forces you to think, OK, well, here's the set of people who feel that they have the wrong body for who they are. And surgery is like a very serious part of this whole human rights movement, which isn't to say that that's the same thing in any way as somebody who feels that they have the wrong nose. But it, I don't know, it muddies the waters of just like heaping scorn upon plastic surgery.
It does muddy the waters. And the case of that particular person, the porn star who wants to step back their looks, I mean, they kind of have both things going on, right? Like there's the sense that she was born in the wrong body and then that change was made. And then there's a sense that the body has to look a certain way that porn star bodies are supposed to look. You know, so if we're going to start judging, like, where does our judgment come in? Maybe that's what makes me uncomfortable with this kind of show, is that it presupposes that there's this other strange, freakish thing out there that we are going to have a judgmental attitude toward. And the show is kind of dealing out that judgment mm-hmm. in these little portions. I don't know. It just it creeps me out that we are assumed to occupy some place on the continuum of judgment.
Okay. Well, the TV show is called Botched. It's on the E! Network. You can check it out if you so desire. But if you have an interesting opinion about plastic surgery, we'd love to hear it at facebook.com/culturefest. All right. Moving on. Tinder is a dating app. It links into your Facebook profile, so as I understand it, it's hard to game it by being anonymous or pretending you're someone you're not. Once you're in its system, it algorithms you up a series of people who are age, gender, and location appropriate, at which point you swipe right if you like them, you swipe left if you don't, and once you are linked up and matched with someone, you are off and running. You're able to communicate with one another and do as you see fit going forward. It has been compared to the gay online hookup site Grindr, though its founders and now millions of users say, no, not at all. It's a general-purpose dating site. Every single person in this room currently, with one exception, which I'll go into in a second, is a fully partnered, spousaled or pseudo-spousaled human being. So our intern, Anna Schechtman, is on Tinder. We've opened her account. We've got her iPhone in our possession.
She has officially given us permission to yenta her on air. So we can go through these matches, these proposed matches it is suggesting for her, and we can swipe left or right on behalf of the lovely Anna Schechtman.
Let's swipe.
Are you
Let's
ready?
Do it.
The power. Okay. I thought being editor of Slate was powerful, but this is a whole new feeling. Okay, so we've got a 31-year-old here. We won't say his name, although you do get just the first name. Let's consider his eligibility for Anna. This is a guy. He's got sunglasses, arms folded, blue-collared shirt, standing against some kind of rocky tidal area. Very natted up in a tux, kind of a high-contrast black-and-white Instagram situation. This guy looks like he's trying too hard to be cool. I noped him. He got a nope. All right, here's a young guy, 24.
Are we reading his bio? There's a little bio at the bottom. He cooks for a living.
Also a volunteer firefighter, one of the most down-to-earth, honest, loyal, and caring people you'll ever meet. Okay, that all sounds good, but he looks like a total club bro. I don't see him and Anna hitting it off. Can we nope this guy?
Nope.
We noped him. All right, well, you have some very unforgiving yentas here. Anna, nobody on this site is good enough for you. We gave all these profiles close scrutiny. Did watching these fogies interact with Tinder, did that approximate the way you do Tinder?
Yeah, you guys were incredibly generous, I thought. I use the app in a really sort of mindless way, almost the way I would play like online solitaire, which is to say that I just sort of very instinctively start noping and kind of mostly noping for the most part, unless I'm doing something more like what you're doing, which is gathering around with a group of friends, often my sister's involved, and sort of using the app as a sociological study in self-representation, how these guys are selling themselves. And often we take a little bit longer with each
right.
suitor.
And obviously we're looking at it sociologically here, so it's kind of right. fun to scrutinize the postures
totally.
And the milieus.
And narrating their lives as well. I mean, my sister's really good at sort of creating little
bios out of the details you have.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I will say about the app that may not have been clear from that description is the mechanics of it are really fun, like as a sheer online user experience. The notion that you're just confronted with somebody's face. I mean, remember that site Hot or Not at the very beginning of the internet, like in 2002, and it was just like a plain white website, like we need some like zither. Take yourself back to like Windows 95 and then just picture like two photos, or maybe it was just one photo. It was one photo and a binary vote. You just like saw a picture of a person and you had to do Hot or Not. And this is basically Hot or Not reconfigured as a dating app with this really fun swiping mechanism where as soon as we, with high dudgeon, deem someone too pompous to be worthy of Anna's time, we can just swipe them.
And unlike Hot or Not, you don't know when you're noped, right? You have no idea when someone is viewing your profile or swiping it.
Right. So you only know when you are a match with someone, which I think is part of the reason why defenders of the site say that it is not just good for women, but a sort of good for all potential prospective daters out there, because you don't know when you're being spurned, but you do. The notion of consent is sort of built into the app. Everyone has said, I am interested in talking to this person, and that's the only way that a conversation can be initiated.
Right, and also I'll chime in as a fogey, but it seems to me that to accuse the app of being shallow misses the mark, because it's really a semiotics of self-presentation, right? You're getting inside what someone thinks about themselves, whether or not the photograph, by the way, photographs can lie. I mean, but there's a way in which they can't lie. The person might or might not be as nice looking as they appear in the photograph, but they have chosen a mode of self-presentation, which is extremely revealing. And look, you're always going to see someone first, and then you're 99% of the time, and you build upon something that's immediate and instinctive, and it obviously goes someplace completely different or it doesn't. But nothing about it on its face offends this old fogey, but some people do feel like it needs to be defended against what precisely? And it's more than just the shallowness of it, right?
Yeah, well, also, I just had one other thought, too, about the so-called semiotics of Tinder, is that a friend of mine recently told me, I think maybe in part to flatter me, that he has noticed that girls doing crossword puzzles on Tinder is a sign of, I'm a smart girl. That's the cue for smart chick. Whereas girls riding camels on Tinder, which for a while was, I guess, some sort of trending trope, signaled, I like rich dudes. So... So there is, a field
of study
here. I
date only Saudi millionaires.
there is a field of study for sure. You have to put yourself out there a lot on those sites.
So we had, sadly, not that startling news out of Silicon Valley a couple weeks ago, where one of the founding members of Tinder, and there's some debate about whether she can really be counted as a founder, who has since left, has sued the company for sexual harassment, and you know, included in the suit are a series of totally disgusting, piggish text messages that include sexism, racism, homophobia, and some other really charming traits. And she accuses this guy of sexual harassment, accuses the company of not properly recognizing her contributions as a real founder. and then says when she tried to escalate her concerns about the behavior of this executive to the CEO, he dismissed her claims and called her dramatic, and then she was ousted from the company. So, you know, the suit hasn't been resolved. It was filed, but it did sort of get heaped onto the pile of, isn't the culture of Silicon Valley disgusting? Isn't the bro-grammar culture totally out of hand? It's sort of gotten slotted in there, and it suddenly raises questions about, wow, this actually fairly woman-friendly app has arisen out of apparently what sounds like a possibly very woman-unfriendly work environment. So I don't know if that should complicate all of our feelings about this swiping service or not.
I think it's a really interesting question. But, you know, funnily enough, it's a question that confronts people in a more slightly more buried way with Facebook. I mean, Facebook was started by Zuckerberg at Harvard as a kind of demeaning rate women.
Very hot or not style.
It was a hot or not and kind of demeaning rate women website. And, you know, I think if we need to peer into the character of the founders of platforms that turn out to be kind of virtual panaceas in many ways, we're going to get very confused about how we use a lot of technology. In the same way, if you peer into the soul of an author of a book you admire, it might turn you off of Anna Karenina or Middlemarch. You know, maybe we just have to disconnect them completely. If women have found a way to use this in a way that enhances their lives and doesn't abridge their dignity, I think maybe we just have to accept, you know, I mean, look, I can't convince anyone to patronize a business that's run by and profiting a creep. I mean, there are plenty of, believe me, corporate businesses I won't go near simply because of the nature of the founder. On the other hand, I mean, you know, it is what it is. It's kind of a generic platform. It's a bunch of bits and bytes, and it happens to work to your benefit. This other situation will play out as it plays out.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, repressed material on dating sites. And if the sort of misogyny of the founders is something else that we're all repressing in order to go about using it, that strikes me as not...
Right. If you already have to ignore all the harassing emails in your inbox,
right,
maybe, and all of the nopes, maybe you can ignore the creeps who started the thing, too.
Yeah. And for the sake of everyone's dating success, I would probably advise repressing it, because I tried to initiate a conversation with someone on Tinder about this very question, and he stopped talking to me.
Okay. Well, on that note, the dating site is called Tinder. It's not a site. It's an app. Steve, you're a fogey. swipe right, baby.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our program where we endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you have?
This week, I'm going to endorse a new, relatively new podcast called You Must Remember This, that's about film history and Hollywood, classic Hollywood history. It's narrated and produced and created by Karina Longworth, who used to be the film critic for the LA Weekly, or one of their film critics and editors. Before that, she was a film blogger in New York. I've been following her writing for a while and have always found her an interesting voice on film. And I just love what she's doing with this podcast. It's still sort of in beta. There's only about 9 chapters so far, and she's sort of figuring out how long it's going to be, what the form's going to be like, will there be interviews. But it's really fun to watch it take shape. So she's had episodes on Frances Farmer, the Hollywood star who famously went crazy and had to be institutionalized, a wonderful episode on Judy Garland, and a 2-part episode on the loves of Howard Hughes. So it's all sort of, you know, scandals of old Hollywood kind of stuff, and beautifully produced with lots of film clips and music clips worked in. So try subscribing to it on iTunes and see what you think. You Must Remember This with Karina Longworth.
Well, that sounds very cool. Julia, what do you have?
Well, I have rediscovered something that I was not in love with the first time around. I think we talked about the HBO show Veep, the comedy about Julia Louis-Dreyfus being the vice president when it first premiered, and then we've, you know, in our way, ignored it for the subsequent seasons. And I never liked it that much. My husband's always been a very big fan of it. I love Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but I felt like all the characters were galoots, and I was sort of rooting against them all, and they were all so petty, and I just couldn't get with it. But then in a flurry of catching up over the weekend, I watched this most recent season, and somehow the show seems to have evolved, and the cretinous characters that bothered me in season one have all become, like, fully realized cretins with hearts. They're still horrible people, but they're somehow horrible people that I find it easier to root for a little bit, and I find the show slightly less devoid of soul and happiness. So I recommend the season of Veep that recently concluded. It's just really funny and sweet and rootable.
I want to check it out. I really do. All right. So this I'm endorsing a kind of a experience that one can have other places than the specific place that I'll then endorse as well. But for my wife's birthday, I gave her a bunch of things, sort of a surprise experiential birthday, one experience of which was getting a his and hers massage, which I had never done before and was exactly the kind of thing I never thought I would do. But as my wife and I appear to be going through life and marriage parallel to one another and in near complete silence, but with a degree of sustaining intimacy, it turned out to be a lovely metaphor for our relationship. And it audibly snorted at my description of my love for my wife. I don't care that you're the boss.
I'm sure your wife snorted too.
Thank you. Anyway, I thought it was kind of a great experience in a weird way. It's so The Bachelor in some ways, you know, penultimate episode of The Bachelor, but it was, I thought, just kind of a cool...
So you're endorsing getting his and hers massages. With
or
your...
his and his, or hers and hers, or
us and us
question
massages.
Mark and question mark, or whatever. Yeah, exactly. But here's my pitch for it, which is, you know, what would you do if you were, you know, a married person and you went and had an experience and you really liked the experience, you sort of pop up from it and you say, hey, I just did this thing, it was kind of amazing, and you describe it. You know, what I like about it was you both have the same experience. At the end of the experience, you don't need to talk about it with one another. You just sort of had the same thing. It was really nice. But the thing that I really want to endorse, because of course this is a silly thing, the his and hers massage, is Hudson, New York, where I live, gets a lot of things wrong, even though it's a lot of hype is thrown at it. It's gotten this one thing absolutely right, which is this spa on the main street of Hudson called Bodhi, B-O-D-H-I. Absolutely everything about the aesthetic of the spa is done beautifully right. It's just a lovely place. Highly recommended.
All right.
All right. Well, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone in the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.